The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
This is The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on the following show are solely those of the host, guest, and its callers. It's time for The Growth Strategist. Here is your host, Aldana Ambler.
Welcome to the show. This is The Growth Strategist, and I'm Aldana Ambler. And each week we rotate through different growth strategies for mid-market companies. One week it'll be franchising. The next week it'll be geographic expansion. And the next week it might be an IPO. Then we also rotate through different industries. And so our guests are people who are from the mid-market companies between 20 and 200 million who've successfully executed the growth strategy of the week. And this week we're talking about repositioning. I mean, you actually take a company that's doing one thing and say, you know, this isn't quite adequate for us, it's not getting us the results we want, or the market has changed, or whatever really prompts you to do it, and we're going to turn this thing. Now, at 20 to 200 million, this is not easy to do. It's hard enough to do for a startup who's in a solo practice or has a few employees to reposition. So what on earth would make you want to do that? So we have a guest a little later on. I'm going to introduce him that, you know, he hasn't done the total repositioning I've seen from some other industries going from manufacturing to service. But when you take a relatively small broker lessor firm and turn it into a full service funding outfit and you hard charge this thing to $75 million in a few years, that's repositioning. So I think you're going to be interested in his story. Now, before I get too far, I want to foreshadow some of the shows coming up, and one in particular. On May 1st, we're going to be talking about ESOPs, and that's the employee buyout of companies. And Claire Toth will be our guest. She's from Point View Financial Services. Now, that's going to be a fascinating program. Several people have asked me to do a program on that. You've heard from my background that over the 36 years that I've been a growth strategist, and my first company was started 36 years ago, I grew it to 123 full-time consultants and 6 offices in international, and went through an ESOP. And it was an interesting experience having 33 partners buy it out over a period of time. And, you know, the whole it was almost like an out-of-body experience. And the whole machination of, you know, exactly what days are you offering which, you know, shares and how do you make it affordable for employees. And it's a really good way to keep your employees tied in. Who else is going to want the company more than the people who are living it and making the money? But there's some, you know, details of it that make it hard to do. The funding of it, exactly how the cash management works. It's not been as popular in the last few years as it was back in the 90s. So we're going to talk about, you know, when should you do an ESOP, when shouldn't you, what are the mechanics of it, how do you fund it, you know, how do you keep people involved, and what are the implications to staffing. So that's on May 1st, and we have a guest that's going to be helping us to look at the different methods of an ESOP. Now, back to today, we're talking about repositioning. And what I'd like to do is just kind of frame the question before we talk to one person about his journey in doing this. Why would you do it? What would make you say, I'm going to change this company? I don't like the way it's going. There must be more. And those are the kind of questions that prompt it. So in my experience, I find that it's when the owners of the business, when they're looking at their numbers, they've hit a plateau. They've hit that stubborn time when the numbers are hovering, you know, their gross volume's hovering at the same level, and it's kind of resistant to change. They improve the efficiencies, and maybe they improve some of their sales techniques, and it still stays at about the same level. And they were ambitious, and they thought they were going to have, you know, they're going to beat the industry averages in growth. So something must be wrong with their model. That's one way you see it. Second way you see it is if you can tell there's changes in the marketplace coming. You know, you've read about some technology, or you know there's consolidation in the industry, or there is a negative, like a court case. Sometimes, for example, when Enron hit, a lot of companies revisited their model, even though they weren't unethical or they didn't have a problem with their board. It still was enough of an earthquake to have people revisit and make sure that they didn't have to reposition their business so they didn't seem like Enron or another company. It could just be from insufficient profit. You may just have a higher desire for a net profit than the model that you picked, or the industry you picked, or the approach that you chose. And if you know, some of us just want to have a higher return. The markup on some business is just pretty low. I've seen some wholesalers that love their industry. They love warehouses. They love trucks. They love making product move. And when they watch the consolidation and they watch the price erosion and the competition, it's just too much work for the amount of money that they can net. And they'd have to revisit and figure out a different thing to do, even though they love the industry and there's a whole lot of people doing it. And the primary reason I find that people look to reposition their business is that they psychologically wanted to be leaders. They wanted to lead the marketplace. They wanted to be first at something. They wanted to be the big kahuna, whatever you want to call it, but there's almost a personality attached to you're in the lead. And you find yourself following. You find yourself being part of the pack. You find yourself doing some of the similar things that other people are doing in the industry, and it just leaves you dissatisfied. Even if your numbers look good, I find that psychological, you know, marketing-wise, you're a leader. You know that that's why you went into business. The fun of it is being first, and you're not first anymore, and it's not okay. Now, if you can identify with that, then you go through a series of questions of, well, how are you going to do this? The mechanics of repositioning are not easy. Can you imagine that? You know, you're on a roll. You got your production moving in one direction. You've got your metrics keeping track of, you know, exactly how your widgets are getting out and how you're moving them, and you've got your staffing that way. How do you reposition? Now, I'm going to tell you one story, and then I'll go through a couple of the questions. It kind of sounds funny because it's from something from, you know, 1800s to early 1900s. My relatives on my father's side had a shipping business, and they were in sale. I mean, of course they were in sale. That's what they had, wooden ships, large sails, you know, multi-masted schooners. Can picture it? Well, when the coming of the industrial age, we had things like steam, and we had coal, and we had different kinds of engines. If you were a master ship crafter, I mean, you really had artisans that could, you know, make the wood just sing, just be gorgeous, and these sleek ships would sail. What would you do? And I've gone over the records, and I've listened to the stories to hear how did they do that. And it was an amazing process of running parallel, because the company had a culture of loyalty and learning. They knew what drove them. It wasn't ships. You know, they knew that their culture was the people being loyal to the business. And because that was, you know, it's like an extended family, they're just dropping the sales. They're just going into the mechanics, going into metal, going into the tin box sitting in the water. Wasn't going to be for them. Now, someone else looking at them would say, what on earth are you doing? If you're going to get into this new stuff and steam and you know, mechanics and engines, and you're going to need these dirty-nailed people. You know, you're going to need a completely different type of worker. You get rid of these artisans. Get rid of the people that are just so into the romance of sailing. You just let them go. You can't afford to do both. It would have killed them. It would have been contrary to who they were to just let the key people go and just replace them with a whole new group. But that may not be what you would do. Now, they ran parallel for, if I got the numbers right, it was almost 30 years. Now, you know how expensive that would be? It's like having two businesses. It would be like, you know, we are, you know, we're phasing out the sale, but we're going to do it the right way. We're phasing in the steam, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it must have been right for them because it's a long story, obviously. But now, you know, they are the largest exporter between Europe and China, and they have these billion-dollar ships that they do. And if you want to visit the Albert D. Rickmer ship, my father's name, you can go to the Nordsee and you can go on a visit. You can walk on these ships, which is pretty impressive given all they went through during World War II when Hitler decided to burn their ships. Who are you? When you talk about repositioning, before you start spending money and getting into the marketing and declaring what your new thing is, pause for a moment and make sure you know who you are. Because if you burn the bridge, if you deny who you are, you could throw away some of the attributes that could help you do the repositioning. So, for example, I gave you that one example. Let's try one that's more abstract. When you make your move, no matter if it's a total repositioning or just a new product or just some kind of new marketplace you're going after, do you do it through market research and marketing and making a statement about your offering and kind of doing things like direct mail and entertainment and open houses as a relationship built. And then you kind of find the customers that react to what you're doing. I call those a build and find kind of company. If your natural inclination in what you've done before has been market research, marketing, production, here's the kind of thing that we've decided we're going to do, now we're going to find people that agree with that. Your two key people would probably need to be the marketing person and the production person. You get it? Because an engineer or somebody that's got their, you know, they've figured out the best widget. Those are your two lead people. Someone who understands the market you're going after and communicates to the market. And the production people that can deliver on what you said you were going to do. And you do things like consistency, and you have a set price point, you have a model, and you're going to make your money based on consistency. All right. Or are you sales-oriented? Are you the type that when you go after a new marketplace or a new product, you send out a rainmaker that gets new contracts? And the whole idea of this is they meet with individual prospects and they listen, and there's a key point in the conversation where that person says, based on what I hear you say, here's what we can do for you. And it's a tailored response. Now, they can come back, and they're going to have 10 different things that they want if you lead with sales. So what you're going to need behind something like that, I call this a promise and hurry model, you're going to need somebody who is really good at sourcing, training. You know, the purchasing agent's going to be really key. Now, hear how different those two models are, and there's two more. But if you don't know which one of those you do, you're all over the place. And when you try to reposition, you don't know who you're going to hire. You don't know who's in the lead, who's going to follow. You don't know if you're standardizing your price or making it a flexible price. You don't know if you're a job shop or a production house. You get it? So I've seen people who get all excited about repositioning, and they hire a rainmaker. They send the guy or the gal out there to get great big accounts and do whatever you can. You know, make sure that the new prospects that are up for this new thing are totally happy. Do whatever they want. And they come back with contracts. And then they can't deliver. So which of those, just those two, are you? Because when you go through repositioning, boy, will you find out. In the arguments and the day-to-day and the bleeding of cash flow, you better be centered before you reposition. Let's try another one of the methods. Are you a deal-led person or company? Donald Trump, for example. It's not a matter of what the widgets are like. You know, it's a matter of how do you put the deal together. In fact, how the company is financed would be, okay, on the concept. And so they put in, like a developer would put together the idea. They'd get paid across the top for managing the idea. And then when all the money comes together, when the funding sources come together and the contracts come together and the vendors come together, et cetera, then they commit. Until all that works out, they don't do anything. So in their case, you're going to lead with equity deals. You're going to have people like project managers. You're not going to be leading with marketing. You're not going to be leading with sales. You're going to be leading with the deal makers and the project managers to deliver on project-specific promises. And then a fourth style is innovation-led, and those often had like what I call a sponge at the top. You know, you're sponging in what the marketplace is, the kind of relating to what the market is telling you, and it's innovation, and you have small work groups, and one of the key people behind you is like the office manager who's the glue to make it all happen. Do you know who your two key people are? Because if you don't know now, and the model's not sound, when you go into repositioning, it is amazing how fast you'll find out that you have a conflict in style. And even if you're trying to throw a whole new kind of product in or a change in marketplace, if you're not centered in the style of the business, it's too expensive. It's too hard. It's too confusing. You'll have conflict. You'll have people quit. You won't know how to keep score. You get it? So you get yourself centered on the style, and then you can ask the question about, okay, we've picked one of those four. We know whether or not we're a deep pockets entrepreneur. We know if we're a sponge and buffer. We know if we're a promise and hurry, or we know if we're a build and find. Which are you? Then you can ask, all right, strategically, what marketplaces are we talking about? What's the difference between this new offering that we're saying we're going to do compared to other people? Who are a couple of the key people that we need to have in place? What are we doing process-wise to execute this really well, and how are we going to manage money? And several of you have heard me say, it always comes down to the alignment of strategy, people, execution, and cash. It always does. But you can't even ask those questions unless you're centered in your style. Now, as you listen to the story of Brent Hall, and I'm going to introduce him after the break, one of the first things you know I'm going to ask him Which style is he? How has he done this major metamorphosis? Because it's pretty impressive. Listen to it and see if you would have done it a different way. This is The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. We'll be right back.
From the stock market floor to your computer, you're listening to Voice America Business.
If you're a struggling business trying to get to the next plateau and would like to learn more about what Aldana can do for you, log on to thegrowthstrategist.com. Listen to some of our many satisfied clients.
We called in the Growth Strategist to do a strategic analysis of our company, design an organizational structure, and improve our management team. The important point is that Aldana Ambler gets it. Her extensive experience coaching fast growth companies has really paid off for us.
Aldana played a key role in driving the rapid growth of our company. We now have a strategic growth plan in place, obtained growth financing, have a stronger management team, and expanded our services, and are already seeing profits. Companies dealing with business growth issues couldn't ask for a better or wiser business advisor than Aldana Ambler.
What are you waiting for? Call 1-888-ALDANA today and see where your business can go tomorrow. Once again, that number is 1-888-ALDONNA. TheGrowthStrategist.com. Achieving accelerated growth with sustained profitability.
When you have a stroke, you may not even notice it right away. But then, time passes, and the symptoms get worse. One minute you feel fine, and the next, your speech could be slurred or not make sense. One side of your body might become numb. You might see double. You drop the TV remote because you can't hold up your arm. That's because, after a stroke, every minute you don't get help is another minute that your brain is being starved of oxygen. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, sudden trouble seeing, speaking, or understanding. If you experience any of these warning signs, call 911 immediately, because time lost is brain lost. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
You're logged on to The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. Call in right now with your questions and comments toll free at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Now let's jump into another segment of The Growth Strategist. Here's Aldana Ambler.
Welcome back to the show. This is The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler, and today I have a guest, Brent Hall. You there?
Yes, good morning.
Well, hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
And you're going to laugh. You and I are in the morning period, especially you, because you're 3 hours earlier than I am. But because it's an international show, you know what's funny is so many people are logging down, downloading the program between like 11 o'clock at night and 1 o'clock in the morning. After they've done, you know, the kids are asleep and they're doing their last email. So good evening to some of you. Well, Brent, you're the CEO of Pinnacle Business Finance, and what I'd like to do is tell a little bit of your story, and you help me with it, because your journey is absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
You grew up in Montana.
Yes.
And moved to California, and I think after high school and attending the University of California, you went to work with your father.
Yes, yes. I'm second generation.
Now, you got to tell us about Heritage Financial, because I don't want to mislead anybody. That wasn't a small company.
No, but it started out as a small company, and it gave me an opportunity as a younger person to watch a transformation of a business or a repositioning of a business from a smaller brokerage to a full-service leasing company.
And in a relatively short period of time, it's like from 1990 to 97 that you were there, that, you know, the industry kind of consolidated and your family sold its interest.
Yeah, you go back to the mid-late 90s. It was a very fast-moving time, a lot of liquidity in the market, and we did just that. And I guess you'd say that one of the final steps in our repositioning was to become part of a consolidation and go public.
Now, see, it's independent equipment leasing and finance company.
Yeah.
So anybody that's not in that business, you know, when you think about all the different competitors, there's not a lot of barriers to entry in that industry. So for them to say, all right, we're going to consolidate, we're going to do something different, that still was a big decision for your family to let, I think you were up at like $400 million at the time.
It was not quite that big, but it was still...
$40 million.
It was a huge decision for us, and we were just at a point where we were seeing a really good growth with the business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at one of those crossroads where you make a decision, do we continue doing what we're doing and grow our company, or do we change gears yet again and take advantage of this new opportunity? And it's you're sometimes blowing with the winds of what's happening in the market. And sometimes your strategies literally change from one of a proactive stance where you're building and working towards a certain goal to almost a reactive by taking advantage of a particular situation, which back in 1997 is what we did.
Now, your family actually felt, let me paraphrase what you're saying and make sure I understand it, you would be more in the lead and more proactive if you sold to First Sierra Financial. Wow.
That was the opportunity at the time.
Now, what was so good about them that made it so intriguing?
Capital.
Okay.
Capital.
And would you be handling bigger deals? Would you be having more fun? What was the lure?
It was the ability to grow our business at a faster pace and at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunity to tap the public markets and raise a lot of money and really grow our business was intriguing. It was one of those unique opportunities that you just don't see every day.
No. And most people would be scared to death to do it.
Oh, yeah. And I can't knock that. It was definitely had its scary moments and its challenges, but risk-reward, and it was a very exciting time for us.
Now, your father ended up being EVP, Chief Operations Officer, and you ended up being Vice President of Mergers and Acquisitions for First Sierra, correct?
Right, right.
With
the sale of the company, you know, our personal duties changed. We physically relocated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my father went from running a large family business to being part of a large public company. And I took on a role of the consolidator, of going out and acquiring 22 companies, to roll those up into a larger platform, take advantage of the strong origination capabilities that were out there.
What a learning opportunity. And not only did you sell the family business and you went public, and now you're part of a roll-up and you were leading it.
Yeah, very exciting time.
Boy, you like learning. you like doing stuff, you know, other people are too scared to do.
Yeah.
Is this a long-time personality thing?
You know, it must be. I don't know. I must be a glutton for punishment.
I don't know. But, I want to have everybody hear that you make it sound matter-of-fact, and, you know, that was the next step and the next step. And most people would go, no way, are you kidding me? I wouldn't know what I'm doing.
Well, you can never always know what you're doing. And, you know, part of it is a gut. Part of it is, does it make sense? It's always, does it pass the classic smell test?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this the next appropriate step for us in our business growth?
Mm-hmm.
And there's only many paths you can take. And
so now, go back to the opening of the show. What style are you guys? What of those four I mentioned, you and your father, and when you think back about heritage, do you identify yourself with any of those?
I think it's a combination of a couple of them.
That's what I thought I heard, too, in the rehearsal.
One,
so which ones do you hear?
You know, one is the build.
Yeah.
You know,
there
was a conscious effort to build the business, and that's not something you can do on the fly. That's very much a proactive stance.
Mm-hmm.
You are adding resources. You know, you're hiring people, training people, adding to your infrastructure. You're positioning your business to go in the direction that you want to go.
Yeah, you guys have been building not just the business, but an approach, a method, your way of doing things that's different from somebody else and saying, okay, this is how we do business, and, you know, there's a routine to it. There's a method. There's a procedure to it. It's not all over the place. You guys aren't selling totally different things to every single person you meet.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the second piece is more of the deal.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, anybody that's doing IPOs and acquisitions probably is a little more comfortable with that than others, yes.
Yeah, obviously there is some planning there,
oh, yeah.
And that's not a shoot from the hip, but that's not typically a long-term a goal that you're working towards. Maybe you are on the outside, but it's more of those opportunities just develop,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes develop very, very quickly, and you change gears to take advantage of that opportunity.
Now, the interesting thing is January of 2000, you left. First Sierra. Now we have to ask why. And how'd they let you go? Didn't you have a non-compete?
Yeah, I did. I filled my contract. My father had retired. The business was going through its evolutions and changes, and you have to think back to the millennium and, mm-hmm. and the time of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of changes were going on.
Were they upset you left?
Oh, it was probably a good time to leave.
Okay.
That business ended up being sold, being acquired by American Express.
I was going to say, a lot of these roll-ups and IPOs didn't make it.
Was no.
It purchased? Did it fall apart? Did it work?
I think it worked. It was definitely a short-term success,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't around long enough to really see how the long-term success would play out. You know, after our IPO, it wasn't 3 or 4 years in mm-hmm. term that whole platform was acquired.
Yeah, and American Express has continued to do that work, or what?
It got absorbed.
Okay.
Into a larger platform.
Yeah.
So going
interesting,
back,
interesting journey. So
yeah.
So all that stuff was happening, and that kind of prompted you to say, "I'm going to start again."
Yeah, I transitioned out of that and had a year or so where I was transitioning out and doing some other things.
Mm-hmm.
And going into the new year, I think like a lot of people, it was one of those, what do I want to do now?
Yeah.
And for me, it was, I know what I want to do. And I want to rebuild a company, and obviously had learned a lot the first time around, and knew the challenges that I was going to be facing. I knew it wasn't going to be easy.
Now you had already helped acquire 22 broker lessor companies.
Yes, right.
Did that make you want to have a company that had the broker lessor identity, or to run away from it?
The former. I was definitely intrigued by the businesses that I had saw. And these were very successful business people.
Oh, yeah, really wonderful people. I've been really impressed with the interviews I've done for UAEL, and, you know, there's some fascinating folks in the industry.
Oh, incredibly fascinating.
Yeah.
And, no, that was definitely a positive. That was a draw for me. And when I started Pinnacle, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be like, you know, many of those great, established mm-hmm. broker lessors that have been out there, some of which for years and years, decades even.
Yeah.
And
but how large did you envision this thing getting?
Well, I knew what kind of company I wanted to be. I just didn't know how far down the road I could go. And so early on, I started to position my business accordingly. Even if it was little steps, I knew the direction that I wanted to go. And my limitations were resources. How much capital do you have? How many people can you hire? You know, the walk before you run.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. You know, positioning and building doesn't have to be at a large scale. And that's what we took here. And
but so, you got itchy after about 5 years.
Oh, it wasn't even 5 years.
Oh.
I was itchy after 1 year. After 1 year, we had started the business, and you know, I started with three people.
Yeah.
I built it up to 10.
Yeah.
And we were a classic equipment leasing brokerage.
Mm-hmm.
And after 1 year, and I was trying to be proactive in building the business,
mm-hmm.
but then a deal happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to change gears. And there was an opportunity to acquire another company
mm-hmm.
here locally. And it was established. It was already a smaller full-service leasing company.
Now, is that how you got your business partner, Tim Seto?
It is not. It is not. There were actually two opportunities. This is 2001.
Yeah.
And there were two opportunities that happened within 4 months of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I took advantage of both of those. The first one was to bring on my partner,
mm-hmm.
One of the greatest things I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
And there was identifying somebody who was one of the predominant business development people in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And
is he great at marketing?
He's incredible.
That's what I thought.
Because,
again, I think that build and find, you need solid, solid marketing and production capability to really deliver on what you're promising to people.
Well, and he saw us and what we were doing, and we saw him and what he was able to drive, and it really was a beautiful marriage.
Now, am I remembering it right? When you really said, we have to modify this, it was that you were selling 75% of what you originated, and you wanted to flip it.
Well, what happened, and that really was the following step, we took advantage of our second opportunity that year, which was the acquisition,
yeah.
And we really felt we were on our way, and this was early 2001.
Okay.
So we started to build our little platform, and we're able to keep 25% of our business. So that was 2001, And that rolled into 2002, 2003, and then 2004. And for those next 3 years, not a lot happened.
Yeah.
I mean, we had some growth, but we really plateaued. And you were telling your listeners earlier how you get to that point where you just plateau, and that's exactly what happened to us.
Yeah, and you're not a plateau type. With your background,
No. No. And
I want to make sure the guests hear what you did, and then we're going to come back and say how you did it. These guys went after $15 million. They're on their way to $75 million by the end of the year. We're talking about a major repositioning here. We have to ask him how he did it. We'll be right back after the break. This is The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler.
...401s, stock, mortgage, retirement, wealth. We cover it all. Voice America Business.
If you're a struggling business trying to get to the next plateau and would like to learn more about what Aldana can do for you, log on to thegrowthstrategist.com. Listen to some of our many satisfied clients.
We called in the Growth Strategist to do a strategic analysis of our company, design an organizational structure, and improve our management team. The important point is that Aldana Ambler gets it. Her extensive experience coaching fast-growth companies has really paid off for us.
Aldana played a key role in driving the rapid growth of our company. We now have a strategic growth plan in place, obtained growth financing, have a stronger management team, and expanded our services, and are already seeing profits. Companies dealing with business growth issues couldn't ask for a better or wiser business advisor than Aldana Ambler.
What are you waiting for? Call 1-888-ALDONA today and see where your business can go tomorrow. Once again, that number is 1-888-ALDONNA. TheGrowthStrategist.com. Achieving accelerated growth with sustained profitability.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
You're logged on to The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. Call in right now with your questions and comments toll-free at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Now let's jump into another segment of The Growth Strategist. Here's Aldana Ambler.
keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
You're logged on to The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. Call in right now with your questions and comments toll-free at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Now let's jump into another segment of The Growth Strategist. Here's Aldana Ambler.
Welcome back to the show. This is The Growth Strategist, and I'm Aldana Ambler. That was a really long break, but we're going to be, you know, back to talking to Brent Hall of Pinnacle Business Finance. And where we left off is, in the early 2000s, you were looking at your business, and this thing wasn't growing the way you wanted it to. And the model was good, but you weren't getting the kind of traction that you wanted. What did you do to make your decision and to reposition? How'd you choose how to reposition it? Kind of walk us through that decision quickly, if you could.
Yes. Going into 2004, we realized that our business was flat. Mm-hmm. And so we started the process of building. And that was one of the strategies you talked about earlier in your program.
Yep.
That's exactly what we did. And in 2004, we had a fair amount in investment as far as our infrastructure, our personnel, trying to start building to position our company to draw an investor. And so 2004 was a real build year. And we saw a little bit of growth, but it was more of an investment period. And then going into 2005, we went out into the market to look for an equity partner. We knew for us to really grow our business, we had to enhance our balance sheet. And to do that, we had to raise capital.
And you weren't afraid of that because you'd done things like this roll-up and IPO. And
had done,
you know,
it before.
You had equity partners so that you weren't as afraid of it as some other people. But how did you control your origination channel as you went through this?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, you're almost managing two companies at the same time.
I bet it felt like that.
It is. You're maintaining the old while you're trying to build the new.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a transition period. And I look back to those 2 years of 2004 and 2005, and it was very much a transition period.
Now, some of my clients who've gone through that, they've actually had to do like a health check to make sure the key people had the stamina and got some sleep and were ready to do this. Did you kind of look around and make sure that you had the energy to go through this?
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. Even personally, I did some really weird things personally. I started doing Ironman triathlons.
I'm not surprised.
Just,
I mean, you know, you have to have the physical stamina to think as you go through negotiations. How'd you find your first, you know, round of money?
Well, what we did is we secured some investment bankers out of New York.
Mm-hmm.
We put together a book on the company. Again, we put a lot of investment in 2004 and preparing ourselves for this move. And in 2005, went to market to look for three investors. And it took us a year.
Oh, yeah, and people underestimate how long it takes.
Well, in three separate opportunities, we went through three engagements before we found the right one.
Did you use an intermediary or do it on your own?
We used an intermediary.
Okay. Well, because that sometimes saves time and money and such. And I've seen people get in this leadership repositioning mode, get stubborn, and think they're going to be able to find a venture capitalist or find private investment all on their own, and they don't take help.
Well, you can find money,
yeah,
but it's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking for a partner that would not just bring capital in, but would bring some additional value adds to help us continue the growth of our business.
Yeah.
And
where did you end up getting money?
We found it from an English money manager out of London.
There you go. They have that international thing again.
Very much. And that came as a surprise to us.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't something we had really thought about or planned for, but mm-hmm. ended up going. With the investment made, we went back to the markets to secure a much larger debt facility.
Mm-hmm.
Our business plan was, in essence, to flip our business model.
Mm-hmm.
So as you talk about a reposition, I'm talking about a complete polar change.
Meaning what? Now explain that to the
well,
listener.
From retaining 25% of our business and selling 75% to doing just the opposite.
So like a broker lessor doesn't hold the paper on the deals.
Correct.
They sell it, they do the transaction, and then they sell their portfolio. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, correct.
And so you were wanting to change it so that you'd hang on to the portfolio and be the funding source.
Yes, from a sales strategy to a retention strategy.
So you really needed to have an infusion of capital so you could become, you know, the equivalent of like the funding, a bank, you know, a funding source.
And go from selling to a funding source to being a funding source.
And yet you continued to be a broker lessor. You were kind of like still selling. You're still,
yes,
you know, working the transaction
at the same time.
Wow. how did you have enough cash to do this? Because a lot of times when people bring in outside investors, there's this delay and the lawyers and the cross the T's, dot the I's and the due diligence. How did you end up managing your cash through all that?
We had, well, we planned for it and we modeled it. And when we sat down with the investors, and we had a year to go through this,
mm-hmm.
we did a lot of modeling. And again, we had done a good job of positioning the company, so a lot of the work had already been done.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of additional development that had to be done as far as the infrastructure and the platform.
Mm-hmm.
It was more of the capital injection that was needed. And once that was made, we could launch from there. And that's
but you're making it sound like there wasn't any pain through this. It was
there was lots of pain.
I mean, most people going through this, you know, I've helped people get money. I'm an intermediary for some companies getting VC money, et cetera. And one of the things that's tough is you're negotiating for money, and so you're almost distracted from the business. And sometimes some key people quit because they didn't get the attention they were used to, or it feels like it's got a cultural change in the business, or they're afraid of where we're headed. Did you lose some employees through this process?
We did lose some. And that actually affected us.
Okay.
We were very sensitive to that, and one of the areas that we invested in was our staff,
yeah.
was the culture. We actually had certain key people here focused on maintaining the culture of the business. They were working groups,
mm-hmm.
if you will. Like, we would focus on technology or a servicing platform or financing. We did the same thing on the cultural side. We were going through such a significant shift in
mm-hmm.
our business.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to spin out our people.
Well, yeah, somebody thinks they signed up to be in a relatively small broker lessor business and they knew what they were doing. And then now they don't know what they're doing because they're going to be in this funding source company. And a lot of folks get, you know, even if they're really bright, they used to know what they were doing. It's kind of disorienting to think, well, now tomorrow I'm not going to know what I'm doing.
Right. Right. And am I still an important part of this company? We're no longer seven people. We're 57.
Who was leading the operational stability? What's our methodology? How do we follow through? How do we define efficiency for your company at that time?
Myself.
Wow.
Myself.
So you're the internal guy.
Yes.
You're the deal maker and the internal follow-up guy.
Which made it challenging. And it was at that time where we started to go through a significant cultural shift because my time and my focus was being drawn away.
Yeah.
And it really was probably the most challenging time for us because I went from the small business owner who was there on site every day, active with the business,
yeah.
to not being there.
Yeah, and isn't it amazing? I mean, you don't have to comment on this because I don't want to embarrass any of your employees, but isn't it amazing how somebody will act like, you know, mom left them or dad left them when you go through this, and that the identity of, you know, wanting to be with the boss and feeling slighted if you can't pay attention to them, all that gets exaggerated during these kind of transformations.
Well, it's like any other relationship.
Yeah.
So that is very, very true. And
yeah.
you can't ignore that. And one thing I've learned early on, your people can make you or break you.
Yeah.
And you do want to bring them along.
Did it pick up or slow down your process of negotiations, your people's reactions to it all?
You know, it actually, I have to give them credit. Most of them stepped up, and they, too, bought into the excitement and the opportunity, the direction that we were going as a company. And with a couple of exceptions, everybody really plugged in and helped us make this transformation.
Now, how often did you have to, like, give a presentation or an update on where you're going, what's the vision, you know, what's the status?
I was very proactive in that, and that was part of my strategy, was to keep them in the loop as much as I could,
mm-hmm.
and literally weekly. Updates, what's going on, where we're doing, and it helped create that sense of excitement
mm-hmm.
and ownership and that
mm-hmm.
they were a part of it. It was very much a collective thing. It wasn't just me or Tim
yeah.
or just the owners of the company. It was a collective thing. We were all in this together. It is very much a team effort.
You know, that's one of the things that makes these work, is I've seen some of my clients, because time drips through their fingers as they're doing these negotiations. You know, all of a sudden a month will have gone by, and they might not realize that employees don't know where things stand and will have gotten nervous again. So weekly makes an awful lot of sense. Can you believe we're already at the last break? Got to take a break, and we're going to come back. I want to hear some advice from you for people to know when do they need to preposition and what it takes to go through this process. This is The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. We'll be right back.
keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
If you're a struggling business trying to get to the next plateau and would like to learn more about what Aldana can do for you, log on to thegrowthstrategist.com. Listen to some of our many satisfied clients.
We called in the growth strategist to do a strategic analysis of our company, design an organizational structure, and improve our management team. The important point is that Aldana Ambler gets it. Her extensive experience coaching fast growth companies has really paid off for us.
Aldana played a key role in driving the rapid growth of our company. We now have a strategic growth plan in place, obtained growth financing, have a stronger management team, and expanded our services, and are already seeing profits. Companies dealing with business growth issues couldn't ask for a better or wiser business advisor than Aldana Ambler.
What are you waiting for? Call 1-888-ALDANA today and see where your business can go tomorrow. Once again, that number is 1-888-ALDONNA. TheGrowthStrategist.com. Achieving accelerated growth with sustained profitability.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
You're logged on to The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. Call in right now with your questions and comments toll free at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Now let's jump into another segment of The Growth Strategist. Here's Aldana Ambler.
The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
You're logged on to The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. Call in right now with your questions and comments toll free at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Now let's jump into another segment of The Growth Strategist. Here's Aldana Ambler.
Welcome back to the program. This is The Growth Strategist, and I'm Aldana Ambler. And today we're talking with Brent Hall of Pinnacle Business Finance. And I want to make sure we mention that the UAEL, you're on that board. Tell
yeah.
everybody what the United Association of Equipment Leasing Board is.
That is the governing board for the association. It's an association made up of a variety of broker, lessors, service providers, and funding sources. And it's a collective where we come together to focus on what's important for our industry, networking, education, best practices of doing business.
Now, I'm real excited because this, as of Friday, we're both going to be off in Las Vegas. And I've been asked to do two or three presentations. We're going to be talking about growing past plateaus. Where do they come from? What do you mm-hmm. do? Then we have a presentation that's on two or three of the growth strategies out of a list of 20 that I'm recommending for your industry. And then there's a session on succession. So I'm kind of a featured player on Friday. So I'm excited about meeting the various people in your industry, and I'm real appreciative of UAEL inviting me. So anybody who's hesitant to go to that or hasn't booked their trip, they should do that because it's going to be a great conference.
We've already sold out and look forward to seeing you.
Oh, isn't that good? Well, we're going to have a good time. Thursday night I'll meet you at the reception. I'll meet you actually in person.
Correct.
That's how I met Brent first. The people that are listening, they're always curious about where I met my guests. Some of them have been clients and some people that I've met in my speeches and some that I've financed. And, you know, so it's a whole range of how I get these people. Anyway, now what we need to go back to is your advice. And one of the questions I would have is you go through this transformation. People knew you as a broker lessor. They knew you as doing the transactions. Now you're going to say you're a funding source. How'd you manage the marketing message so that the market wasn't confused?
Well, the first thing we had to do is we had to plan. And we had to put all the pieces in place. And the second thing, we knew that was not going to happen overnight. And it had to be a very organized phase-in to make sure that our message was not confused. It did not change too significantly. We wanted to make sure that the changes were always positive.
Mm-hmm.
They were enhancements. This was better.
And people are so preoccupied. I imagine you're going to have to, you'll still have people thinking one way about you, you know, a couple years later.
Oh, sure.
You know,
oh, sure.
I mean, people are preoccupied. They're not dumb, you know, but you know, you're not going to be their top priority. It's going to take a while for it to sink in.
Yeah,
did you double or triple your marketing budget?
Well, we did. We went through, that was part of the investment that we made, and we went through a significant brand change as far as enhancing our brand brand identity, how we got our message out there. You know, we started up two new business divisions to help grow our company.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a significant investment, and with that comes a cost.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest questions I get is, well, gosh, how did you do that? You had to have sacrificed something.
Right.
And the answer is yes, we did.
Would you sacrifice profit?
We sacrificed profit.
You had to have. And yet when I'm listening to you, one of the things I can hear is you must have had a very profitable broker lesser business. It might not have been growing at the rate you wanted, but you had some money even before you went out for the financing from the Cambridge police.
We did, but the steps we were taking were huge,
mm-hmm.
and frankly, it was a very big gamble.
Yeah.
But we felt that it was a controlled gamble. We were educated. We had done our homework. We had strategically placed ourselves and built our organization.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a big step and a big gamble, and to make the change that we made, you can't carry it on your P&L.
When are you going to turn to being profitable again? Is that
this year?
Oh boy,
yeah.
That's fast.
At the end of this year, it's a two-year execution for us.
That's fast.
Post investment. Now, if you include the development of getting the equity, it'd be 3 years.
Right.
So the whole transformation would be 3 years.
That's actually pretty quick.
Yeah, it relatively is. And so people say, "Well, that took a long time."
No.
The flip side is, it really didn't. It was very, very fast.
It feels long when you're living it, watching it, you know, the P&L every month.
Probably the biggest part of positioning is to position yourself to be able to weather that change.
Right.
To go from a significant change in your business model,
mm-hmm.
to have the negative effect on your P&L, which is in essence an investment,
yeah.
to help build your P&L and your balance sheet going forward, and we'll start to see the benefit of that fourth quarter of this year.
Okay.
And going into 2008, when you compare the business in 2008 back to 2005, it'll be a completely different business.
Now, were there a couple of key hires that you had to do in this process?
Absolutely.
Okay, who were some of the key people or positions? That's what I'm looking for.
We brought in a new operations person,
mm-hmm.
someone that if my attention is elsewhere, mm-hmm. there has to be attention on the ship.
Well, and the larger you get, the more you're transitioning from, you know, a president of a small company to a CEO of a larger.
Right.
And you do not have the time to do, you know, the day-to-day operations, even if you're great at it.
Right.
So I'm glad you noticed that. Did you have to bring in the CFO as well?
We haven't yet.
You're at the controller stage.
We were very blessed early on to plug in some key people that had a lot of growth potential.
Mm-hmm.
Our controller was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Our risk manager was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some people plugged in early on that we had the benefit of, we knew they could grow.
Oh, if you have the combination of a good controller and good risk management.
It was great.
You could postpone getting the CFO.
That was key.
Plus, you're obviously really good with money machinations and, you know, all these formulations. Some other folks in different industries that are not in equipment financing wouldn't necessarily know all the numbers, and they would need a CFO sooner.
Right. So for us, it was adding the operations person, someone
mm-hmm.
to, in essence, replace me,
mm-hmm.
and then adding to the senior business development staff to help my business partner, Tim,
mm-hmm.
who's in the same boat that I was. We were growing at such a significant pace.
Yeah.
And we're not only talking double-digit growth, we're talking triple-digit growth.
Yes, we are.
And that's dangerous.
Yeah.
And that has to be...
That's why I'm bringing this up. It's if you ask, you know, if I asked you what would your one piece of advice be to people taking on this type of dramatic growth,
mm-hmm.
what does it boil down to?
I think it boils down to planning and execution. And the two words that are always said to me are focus
mm-hmm.
and patience.
Yeah. It's incredible focus. It does, because you cannot get distracted in the meantime.
No.
You know, I was going to say the perseverance. Maybe it's a little bit different than patience, huh? Is that you have to be be so dedicated to, once you put this ball in place,
yep.
to follow through on it. Because
yes.
if you do it halfway, if you, you know, hold back on your financing, hold back on your hiring,
don't
follow through on telling people things, if you don't follow through on it, then it's a very expensive experiment.
You're in trouble, and it could be a fatal experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really an exercise of laying out a good plan,
mm-hmm.
of making the proper investments, and again, positioning yourself for success,
mm-hmm.
and then doing it.
You know, I kid people about, you know, this type of transformation, this type of repositioning is like becoming pregnant. You can't be half pregnant.
Right.
It happened. It's coming. You know, get used to it. Start figuring out how to and how to deal with Lamaze, how to go to the doctor, yada, yada, blah, blah, because it's coming.
Right.
And just say, you know, say, well, I think I'll go back and, you know, no. And that's one of the key things that I would leave people with. Well, I think you've been a marvelous role model. I'd like you to give some contact information for people who have some questions they'd like to ask you, your email perhaps or your website.
Sure. Sure. We can be found at www.pinnaclecap.com. And my email address is bhall@pinnaclecap.com. And our phone number here at Pinnacle is toll-free 1-800-566-1993.
And after the show, I often get questions, and I will pass them on to you if they come through me. I am at aldonna@ambler.com. If you know my name, you can reach me, aldonna@ambler. The website is thegrowthstrategist.com. And the toll-free number in the United States is 1-888-ALDONNA, A-L-D-O-N-N-A. Just ended up with too many phone numbers, and so if you deal directly with me, that's the number you get. My wish for the guests and the listeners every week is the same. I wish for you accelerated growth with sustained profitability. This is the Growth Strategist, Aldonna Ambler, signing out.
Voice America Business would like to thank you for logging on and tuning in to The Growth Strategist. Join us each Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for another exciting episode of The Growth Strategist, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.